When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Don Neely view system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Thank you for listening to the Late Breaking F1 Podcast. Make sure to check out new episodes every Wednesday and every Sunday. Hello and a very warm welcome to the Late Breaking F1 Podcast presented by Sam Sage and me, Ben Hocking, on what is today the review of the qualifying for the Australian Grand Prix, which you might be able to tell we're doing at 90% volume because we'd like to keep our partners at 6:30 in the morning.
I think I'm at about 30% volume because I also have a neighbour downstairs who will absolutely march up and crucify me. And I'm, you know, folks, if you've been around a while, you know I'm not the quietest of gentlemen in the world. So yes, one partner upstairs, one neighbour downstairs, and the loudest man in all of England is in the middle. So we are trying to be careful and quiet and not upset people.
Do you know what's really odd is that Harry's on 0% volume.
Oh, Harry's not here again, is he?
Ah, he's done that thing again.
He's good at that, just not being here. Good job, mate. See you soon.
Never mind. He might be back for tomorrow. I think he's a bit unconfirmed on that one. So, hey, you'll find
out
with us, folks.
Guest, Harry.
But anyway, we're here to talk about Australian Grand Prix qualifying. And Max Verstappen took pole position in what was, in the end, fairly comfortable margin over his nearest challenger, that being Carlos Sainz in the Ferrari. Promised to be a bit of a closer battle than that. Maybe we were drawn in, but certainly through practice, Red Bull didn't quite seem as on top of things as they usually are. And even early in qualifying, it seemed fairly close. But as soon as Q3 rolled around, Max Verstappen really asserting his advantage. Sergio Perez in third, Lando Norris in fourth, with Charles Leclerc in fifth, rounding out the top five. From Verstappen's perspective, obviously him on pole position, not a massive shock in modern Formula One, Sam, but in terms of the margin itself, surprised at how big that was?
Yeah, I am surprised. Two and a bit tense is, it's not nothing in Formula One. In any other sport, you might go, well, that's literally the blink of an eye. But in Formula One, that is a quarter of a second. And a quarter of a second is still a lot to make up for around a racetrack, around one lap when your lap time is under 1:20. There's a big difference there. But I do want to commend Max Verstappen. I really do feel like as much as we saw throughout practice and the early stages of qualifying, that Red Bull looked like a bit of a struggle to hook up, to really get into a comfortable place. And Sergio Perez came out and said it quite early on in the session that the tyres were dying off most of the way through the lap. You know, the soft tyre could barely get one lap round that racetrack at full pelt, which maybe explains why there was some differences in pace in sectors and why certain things were jumping around throughout the sessions. But when it comes down to it, during Q3, the three-time world champion pulls it out of the bag and he does what he does best. He does what a champion does. And I do think it was Max Verstappen today that completely elevated that Red Bull and gave it that 0.2 separation. I do not think it was a representation of the car. I really do feel like Ferrari and Red Bull here look incredibly close, incredibly competitive. And Carlos Sainz, who we'll go on to speak about shortly, is recovering from his appendix being removed. And I have to commend just how brilliantly I think he has done all weekend so far. But I really do think that it was Max Verstappen today that hooked up that lap perfectly, managed the tyres brilliantly, sorting his sectors out effectively. And he delivered a consistent time across all three sectors to deliver an absolutely fantastic qualifying lap. So whilst the gap was bigger than expected, I do feel like we got a little bit of that qualifying anticipation and excitement back. I do think it was closer. What is worrying me is the gap further down the grid between the likes of, you know, from fifth place now down to maybe 14th or 15th. It's a far larger gap than it has been. We saw a second separating the entire grid only a couple of races ago during one session, and now it's a second separating the top eight. So, slightly unnerving.
Yeah, I think on that last point, Lewis Hamilton's Q2 departure is something we're going to get onto in a little bit, but it's almost like you have those top five teams, obviously five teams filling out 10 positions, and it's just a question of what is anything weird going to happen to one of those top 10 that will open up an opportunity for someone else. That's essentially the situation we've had the last couple of Grand Prix, in that at Saudi Arabia, it was Ollie Bearman in the Ferrari having his first qualifying session ever. That was the weird, unexpected thing. This time out, it was Lewis Hamilton not getting into Q3. And both of those occasions, it's been Yuki Tsunoda who's been the benefactor of those two. You're right. It does feel like it is a bit set at the moment in that regard. Out front, Max Verstappen, I mean, superlatives kind of running out of them at this point, but highly impressive. And something you said late in your point, which resonated with me quite a lot, was just how consistent it was across all sectors. So we have, even in Red Bull's dominant times, seen that there have been certain tracks where they have been utterly brilliant in a couple of sectors and maybe only okay in a third sector, but because they're so brilliant in the other two, it doesn't matter. Here, it felt like going into the later stages of qualifying that Verstappen needed to find a bit of time everywhere. Like he wasn't being let down by one particular sector. It didn't feel like to me. And the way he approached it was just, yes, one tenth faster in sector one, one tenth faster in sector two. And that adds up very quickly, as you can see by the end time. That margin was, I agree with you completely. It was a surprise to me, which, you could turn around and say, what are you being surprised for, Ben? It's Verstappen in a Red Bull. But certainly through practice in the early stages of qualifying, even if Verstappen was the favourite for pole position, I figured that gap would be less than two tenths.
Yeah, I think what surprised me the most actually is the competition and where it came from. And I don't know if maybe this benefited Verstappen the most, because as much as, okay, they have been absolutely relentless to have Red Bull and Max Verstappen, you would definitely be able to make a case to say that Saturday's performances are not where Red Bull sits at the very top of the tower. You think of the last, 15 or 20 qualifying sessions, and I think they picked up less than half the pole positions, the others being shared across the likes of Carlos Sainz, Charles Leclerc, Lewis Hamilton got one in Hungary, remember? And the McLarens have also been very, very close to that point, with Sergio Perez also picking up, one, I think it was. So Max Verstappen has not had an absolute clean sweep of pole positions over the last 15 to 20 Grand Prix. So that's where the armor shows its chinks in the armor. It's where it shows its weaknesses. And that's where you need to strike, I think, if you are a competitor against Red Bull. So of course, I think it's fair to say that when you see practice being that close, and when qualifying one and qualifying two equally are not really being dominated by Red Bull, you think, okay, something could happen here. The issue is for us as spectators that the competition kind of fell off on its own. Charles Leclerc, who is usually the favourite to put up an absolute fight against Max Verstappen, seemingly off the pace for the entirety of qualifying. Of course, on that final run, delivers a massive mistake running wide on the, not penultimate corner, but the one just before that, which means that he has to abandon his lap, only coming in fifth place. And Carlos Sainz, who, again, I mentioned in the start of my point, absolutely exceptional pace for a man who is still recovering from a very intensive and intrusive surgery. Gets out the car, interviewed there, of course, by Martin's son, Alex Brundle, who is, did a fantastic job, I thought, always does a great job on comms, you know, expressing how are you feeling, how are you coping? And Carlos Sainz, first thing out of his mouth, I'm not running at 100%. I am in pain. You know, I'm being honest with you now where I'm you know, not operating as much as I could. Tells you everything you need to know that Max Verstappen, yes, whilst he delivered a fantastic lap, he's also going up against Carlos Sainz, who's injured, Sergio Perez, who is not a prolific qualifier, the McLarens aren't fast enough anyway, and Charles Leclerc made a mistake. So, yes, great lap from Max, helped by the fact that other people just are not at 100% of their game.
I tend to think as well, Red Bull, like you say, they weren't struggling with qualifying last year, but if it, relatively speaking to its race pace, it was. But actually, rather than you've had Verstappen get three straight poles, obviously, is a clear sign that they are doing far better in qualifying now than they were at the end of last season. But I think the even bigger indicator is where Sergio Perez is at, where, you know, Perez was routinely missing Q3 last year. And that's just not happening so far. I know we're only three races in, but Perez has not necessarily been there with Verstappen, but it's never really been in doubt that he would make Q3 at all of the races we've had so far. He's been on the pace to finish, you know, start in the top five, which again is what he's doing here. He's qualified third, same as what he managed in Saudi Arabia. So I tend to think it's not just Verstappen's pole positions that are an indication that Red Bull have turned the corner a little bit in terms of qualifying. It is Perez's performances as well.
Yeah, Perez is definitely probably the biggest improvement across all of the competitors that we saw fighting at the front last season. I think he has taken that big step up. I don't know if it's the car's stability. The car does look like it's on absolute rails so far this season, and Perez does seem more happy and comfortable. But he's now delivering, realistically, the last weakness he's recovered on that front from what Red Bull have been looking at. When they were looking at replacing that second seat, who could they go for? Will it be Ricciardo, Tsunoda, an outside hire? Maybe Sainz, of course, who is looking for a seat. The question was, well, Sergio Perez's race pace has always been fine, but he lets himself down because he's not starting in a high enough position to actually make the most of that strong race pace. Currently, so far this season, he's rectifying that. As long as he's always within two or three places of that top spot, he's able to get the moves done and put that car into second place where Red Bull need him to be come the end of the weekend. Currently, maximum points other than fastest lap so far this season.
Yeah, and I mean, fair play to Sergio Perez in that he and Lando Norris and obviously Carlos Sainz, they take advantage of things like Charles Leclerc not being on the pace and maybe to an extent, I don't know if he quite would have got there today, but maybe Fernando Alonso in that same regard, where if there are other drivers that aren't quite on their A game, they're just able to fill in the gaps, which is what Perez has done here. I was surprised, like you, that Charles Leclerc wasn't more in the fight. And as you say, he did mess up his final run in Q3. Although you have to say that, yeah, even if he finished the lap, it's not like it was against the grain, right? Sainz did have the pace on Leclerc pretty much all day. So, you know, people will focus on the mistake, but actually Leclerc's pace wasn't on it with his teammate.
No, Sainz was the fastest Ferrari driver so far this weekend. We'll see if that's going to be able to be maintained during the race pace. Of course, we know he has still got that injury that he's recovering from. That might cause him to have to lighten up a tenth or so a lap just to maintain the G-force. Of course, it's being absorbed by his body. But Charles Leclerc, yeah, unusually off the pace. The man, especially on a Saturday, is usually relentless when it comes to applying that top-level pace. But mistakes being made, understeer is clearly a factor of his setup that he's got at the moment. But Sainz looks, he looks firm, he looks strong, he looks comfortable, even with that injury. I don't know if he's being spurred on by knowing that he hasn't got a seat next season, and he has to seek every chance to make the biggest impression he can on any possible, you know, he, like I said before, he's essentially a moving billboard right now. He needs to advertise every single part of his skill set to any employer going. And I think he's doing a tremendous job of it. If I can look at a driver and go, you've just come out of major surgery and now you're still on the front row and you're beating your teammate by 3 months, what can you do when you're fully recovered? That's a great sign for Carlos Sainz fans.
From the driver that qualified in first in Max Verstappen down to the driver that qualified in 12th, that being Alex Albon. Now, the Williams have been in the news quite a bit over the last couple of days, owing to a decision they had to take regarding Albon and his teammate Logan Sargeant. Alex Albon, of course, crashed on Thursday's practice session, leaving Williams with only one chassis to go ahead with throughout this weekend. But rather than Alex Albon sit out the weekend because it was his crash, they elected to make the decision that Logan Sargeant would sit out and Alex Albon would take Logan Sargeant's chassis. So Logan Sargeant, of course, made no appearance in qualifying today. He will make no appearance in the race tomorrow either. Hotly debated as to whether this was the right decision or not. Where do you land on it?
It's a really tricky scenario, and I would argue this is the first time we've seen something like this since when Red Bull gave Sebastian Vettel Mark Webber's front wing, maybe.
Sure.
It's been at least a decade since we've seen a real teammate moment where they're just, I mean, that even isn't as bad as not being given a car, right? That was just an upgrade. So, tricky one. So, it's come to light that Williams are struggling to use Microsoft Excel, which is an interesting development in the world of Formula One. It is the world's hardest program. But let me tell you that once you crack it, Microsoft Excel is genuinely one of the best things that the world has ever created. So, they've decided that whilst using Microsoft Excel, they thought it would be a great idea to not create a third chassis for cost-saving measures. So that's an impact of the cost cap, because they're trying to get ahead in their developmental cycle to make sure that they can get gains later on in the year and in further seasons by putting the money into development rather than building a third, essentially a safety backup chassis. A lot of the teams, I think actually all of the teams bar Williams, have got a third chassis at the track at the moment. Very common, very normal. Now, Alex Albon puts it in the wall. He gets Logan Sargeant's chassis. This is really, really tricky. I think there are two schools of thought here. The first is, how do you look at it from a Williams point of view? Williams themselves have to look at what their best opportunity for maximizing the weekend is. And you'd argue that the man that has scored 84% of all Williams' points since 2022 is probably your safest pair of hands for securing points if that chance were to arise. And to me, that does make sense. He's done a very, very good job at being consistent, qualifying well, and maximizing the car. Equally, if you're Logan Sargeant, you've got to look at this and make the argument that, well, Alex Albon binned it on his own here this time last year. Alex Albon has binned it again on his own this time this year. I've been pretty close to his pace all season. So far, he hasn't particularly finished high above me, other than the mechanical issue that he had in Bahrain, of course, which, you know, some would argue wasn't his fault. And Logan Sargeant has been taking on leaps and bounds in terms of his performance. The other school of thought, of course, is that Alex Albon binned it on his own. He is the problem. He's the one that put it in the wall. Logan Sargeant drove a completely clean session and did a great job. And yet he's the one that is paying the price. He's the one that's being punished for someone else's mistake. So there is a lot of me that just thinks that William should turn around and say, well, tough, Alex, you put it in the wall. You knew the risks that we had here with only one chassis each. You're now going to have to sit out and Logan Sargeant's going to have to take the punt. But equally, Formula One is also a team game. Formula One is about scoring as many points as you can. And we've seen just how rare a commodity points are in this current season. So one point, and I would agree that Alex Albon is by far the more likely to score them, could be worth so much at the end of this season. If, for example, imagine if Haas and Williams are the only two now to score points, and there's three teams below them on zero, that could put them in seventh place again. That's huge money that they could gain. So whilst it is harsh, whilst it is really unfair on Logan Sargeant, I want to emphasize that he does not really deserve the treatment. I do understand it, and logically, mathematically, it does make sense to do what they've done. But good Lord, do I feel for Logie Bear. The boy deserves to have a drive when he did nothing wrong.
I want to talk you through my thought process on this, because it was a really weird one in that I was on one side of the argument and then completely shifted to the other side. So when I saw the news come through, immediately I thought, my mind is made up. Sometimes I need to look at something like a few times or mull it over to think, well, what exactly do I think about this? This, I didn't have to do that at all. I saw the news come through and I was like, great, yeah. In Vows We Trust, right decision. Of course it's the right decision. Alex Albon is way more likely to get points than Logan Sargeant. This is a business. Is it unfair? Yeah, sure. But it's F1. F1 is a very binary sport. We look at points at the end of the year. That's all that matters. Could elevate them in the championship. Way more prize money. Alex Albon has proven race after race after race that he's way more likely than Logan Sargeant on an average weekend to score points. Of course, this is the right decision. And then I realized I was completely and utterly wrong, because there's something that not a lot of people are talking about here. And I, at least when I first saw the news, forgot about it as well. But last season, so much was made, or so little was made, I guess, of Williams's lack of caring, I guess, for whether they beat AlphaTauri in the championship. You'll remember that there was the battle for seventh, and ultimately, you know, Williams did end up finishing seventh, but there was a lot of quotes at the time from James Vowles and others basically saying, it'd be great if we finished there, but also we're not here to finish seventh. We're just here to build the foundations for future years. That's what we're looking to do right now. And surely, based on where Logan Sargeant is at in his career right now, the only reason they are hiring him this year is based on his potential. Like, they're not hiring him based on where he is right now, because that would be ludicrous. They're hiring him based on what they think he could be. Therefore, surely, everything you do this season for Logan Sargeant should be about getting him to a position where you are comfortable with him in your car. I think we can realistically say, I know it's only three races in, Williams are not going to be fighting this season for where they eventually want to end up. They're not going to be fighting for anything higher than probably where they were fighting for last year. In which case, I think they've made a short-term decision here that goes against everything Williams have been trying to do in the last couple of years. Williams, we've given them a lot of credit to say they are looking long-term. They're looking at going back to the glory days of winning championships. That they know they're not going to get that overnight. Therefore, they're making hiring decisions and they're making other decisions that aren't looking at short-term points. It's looking at long-term success. This feels like it goes completely against that and contradicts it, because whilst Alex Albon is more likely to score a point this weekend, what will that result at the end of the year? It could result in a seventh place rather than an eighth, but as history tells us, as in last year's history tells us, that's not what they're worried about. So I actually think they are, not because it's unfair, I just don't think it's the right decision overall based on what they're trying to get from Logan Sargeant.
I came to essentially the same conclusion. I also, I went down the unfair route as a very simple man. It feels like you make the mistake. It's Formula One. You pay the price, right? And Logan didn't do anything wrong. And I don't know a single other team where I would expect this to be the decision that is made, you know, anywhere else. If Max Verstappen binned it in a practice and they ruined his only chassis, do I think they go, Sergio, get out of the car? No, I genuinely don't think Red Bull would do it to them. And I think that this is unfair. I think that Logan Sargeant was doing well and he deserves to have his chance in the sun and, yeah, develop. And the only reason I can think of that, if he's not there for developmental purposes, he's there because he brings in a different form of sponsorship. And if that's the case, they really don't care about him. But this is a huge vote of no confidence from Williams. And if they're trying to build up his confidence and his consistent ability and the way he delivers on track, the worst thing you could have done would be to snatch away his car when he did absolutely nothing wrong and go, the guy who crashed is still better than you right now. It would upset me. And he put in his press statement, didn't he, that this is the hardest thing he's had to do in his motorsport career so far.
Yeah. Like you say, I mean, it's about confidence. Surely Williams sat down at the beginning of this year to say, this is where Logan Sargeant is now. This is where we need to get him to. And in order to get him from point A to point B, we need to build his confidence and give him opportunity to shine. This is strictly working against that, which so long-term brain thinking, like, I don't think it makes sense.
Especially right with the choice of not building a third chassis to try and gain in the future, to try and gain that developmental time, that budgetary change that allows them to invest in the future. You must have said to your drivers, there is a real risk that if you crash the car, that we do not have anything as a backup. We will be out of this Grand Prix. And the team are trying to make massive sacrifice to develop into the future, long-term gain. Please be sensible. Please be careful. Session, what, one, was it? puts it in the wall and damages the car. And Logan Sargeant, yeah, it's, you're right. It goes against the grain for what Williams have been doing. And this is probably the first area of the Vowels administration that I have gone, I'm not sure I see eye to eye with you on this one, James.
Okay, we'll take our break on this episode. On the other side, we've got more qualifying chat. Okay, very warm welcome back. One of the surprises of qualifying was Lewis Hamilton being eliminated in Q2. So he'll start the Grand Prix from 11th place, which was mentioned on commentary as being his worst qualifying position at Australia in 13 years or so. Mercedes really overall continued to struggle because whilst George Russell, of course, out-qualified his teammate again and did make it through to Q3, it's not like he was able to do a great deal with getting through to Q3, which goes against where they were in final practice, where it looked a bit more encouraging. At least from Lewis Hamilton's perspective, Sam, he hasn't exactly qualified brilliantly in the first two races, but he has at least made it through to Q3. It's a bit worrying, right?
Yeah, a bit worrying. I called out in our race preview session when we did our episode that Lewis Hamilton is my man under pressure. And you could see all the way through the practice sessions that he was struggling. P3 was the outlier to see him so high up the session and to see him beating George Russell. I think he ended practice two in something like 16th place. The car is not where his happy place right now. He is not at home in that car. And he's come out and said that he's never felt more uncomfortable in this current car so far. So clearly these experiments that they've applied are not suiting either driver, but Lewis Hamilton is struggling. He is on struggle city right now. He's on that struggle busting 0 points town because him and George Russell were less than a tenth apart when Lewis Hamilton got knocked out. Realistically, George Russell is equally as fortunate to not be sitting there in 11th place with Lewis Hamilton in 12th place, or the other way around, where, you know, Hamilton could be in 10th and Russell in 11th. But we've seen this trend continuing where Russell is just able to maximize that car a little bit more than what Lewis Hamilton is able to, especially in qualifying trim. And he's now qualified Lewis Hamilton for 5 Grand Prix in a row, which is, I don't know if that's a brand new stat, but it feels like the first time that's happened in a long time where Hamilton's been beaten by a teammate 5 times in a row in qualifying. The car isn't good. We can see the car isn't good, but I do think that is being compounded by, it sounds harsh to say, bad driving. Lewis Hamilton's onboard lap when he got knocked out in Q2 was not a good lap. And yes, that is a mixture of the car being difficult to drive. And I also think he's overworking the car. I think he is making mistakes. You know, he's missing apexes due to understeer. He's then having to catch the car, which is trying to swap on him due to oversteer. He's losing time in so many different areas of the track that if he just tidied up one corner, half a tenth is all he needed to get himself into Q3. But realistically, these are tiny, tiny changes that a driver can make. And what is it going to deliver when the car is arguably only the 4th or 5th best car? I argue it's equal to Aston Martin right now. And I do think we're starting to see that McLaren have taken a step forward and are now ahead of Mercedes. Ferrari, of course, comfortably ahead, and Red Bull are literally in a different formula at this point to them. The downfall without this cost cap adjustment that Mercedes were allowed to abuse for year after year after year before it came into effect is clearly showing. And they just are floundering. They don't seem to have a technical direction that they understand and that they can go in. And Lewis Hamilton can't really get too much more out of it. And George Russell, who I think is doing a good job, you know, what was he, 8th? Or 7th, I think it was. I think he's only there because Tsunoda did a brilliant job. And the Aston Martins, I don't think they could do any more. So it kind of got a little bit lucky that he was as high as 7th. Yeah, it's not looking good for Mercedes, and it's looking like an even worse job for Hamilton, who I'm sure is desperately looking at the top end of that grid and going, put me in the red car now, please.
Or in that blue one, that'd be okay as well.
I'll actually have any car actually other than this one, please.
Oh, dear. Yeah, it's tough times for Mercedes, really tough times. And this was essentially called out, I think it was Martin Brundle in commentary in Q1, where Hamilton and Russell weren't that great. And Martin Brundle said words to the effect of, you know, it's top 10 into Q3. It might be quite close. And ultimately it was. And, you know, Lewis Hamilton knocked out in 11th place. Like you say, it was fairly close. But for me, the most worrying thing is not that he didn't make it through to Q3. It's that he wouldn't have had the pace to do anything if he did make it through to Q3. Like, okay, he might have got there, but I don't think he was beating anyone other than the two Aston Martins and Tsunoda, who obviously one of them would have been knocked out in Q2 at his expense if it worked out that way. But there was not a top six on the cards here for either Mercedes driver, which, of course, you know, George Russell qualified quite well in Bahrain. Feels a long time ago now. That was not on today. And it's worrying from Lewis Hamilton's perspective, if you look at the first three races in terms of qualifying, he is Yuki Tsunoda. Like, he is Yuki Tsunoda in that both of their best qualifying positions have been eighth so far this year. Both of their worst qualifying positions so far this year have been 11th. They both have two Q3 appearances and one Q2 knockout. He's essentially completely matching Yuki Tsunoda in qualifying this year, which, no disrespect to Tsunoda, who's been doing a good job, but this is Lewis Hamilton we're talking about. And as you say, that's now five races in a row where George Russell has out-qualified him, going back to the last two races, of course, of 2023. So I don't know. Like, it's race pace-wise, they seem to be a little bit better than qualifying, but not enough that it makes much of a difference. And, I mean, what are the expectations for Hamilton tomorrow? Okay, I think he can probably get into the points, but how far? I wouldn't bank on it being much more than, you know, 4 points, 6 points that are up for grabs tomorrow.
Absolute ridiculous lines that we're saying things like, I kind of think he could get into the points tomorrow. This is the team that delivered that many championships and race wins in a row. And now it's kind of they're a kind of a fringe points team. George Russell is arguably maximizing the car. Who do we think they could beat? Probably Lance Stroll. If Fernando Alonso has a good Grand Prix, I would place a bet on him challenging Russell throughout the race. And I guess Yuki Tsunoda, who has done brilliantly in qualifying, is probably going to fall backwards a little bit. You know, he might finish 10th or 11th and maybe swap places with the likes of Lance Stroll and Lewis Hamilton, because I do think Aston and Mercedes race pace is better than the RB. But yeah, this is dire times, and they need to find something very special to make some changes. I did hear in the old news, in the gossip columns, that they've decided to hire some Ferrari mechanics. So yes, be interested to see if what ones they got. Did they get the ones that don't know what plan A, B, and C are, or did they get the ones that do actually understand aerodynamics?
Yeah, we'll see how it goes for Mercedes tomorrow. It was similar to Saudi Arabian qualifying, where in Sector 1, which, let's face it, Sector 1 is just straight, chicane, straight, and then a couple more corners and that's it. And they're like 4 tenths down on Verstappen's time. And it's like,
you try to get excited, don't you? You try to think, oh, okay, there's a chance. They might be doing something here. And you see, especially with Hamilton, you saw the time come up. He was 0.426 or something off of Verstappen. Yeah. And again, we said this, whilst the gap out front was good, it's not Verstappen's biggest margin either by far. This grid up the front is actually quite compact. So to be half a second away in Sector 1 alone is atrociously slow. It is mind-boggling that they have fallen that far away from the top pace.
Yeah, you're never getting that time back. Minardi. So we've already focused on Yuki Tsunoda getting through to Q3. But of course, Daniel Ricciardo was knocked out in Q1. Put together, time-wise, a fairly good lap in Q1. However, he was track limits-wise, it wasn't all that close, was it? He extended track limits by quite a lot. So, of course, his fastest lap was deleted. That would have been good enough to get through to Q2. And instead, he was knocked out in Q1 and will start the race from 18th position. So a lot of work for him to do. What did you make of the session? Because you could look at it through the lens of he hasn't shown a great deal of pace so far this year, but did show good pace in that lap that was invalidated. But of course, it counts for nothing. So what do you think?
I mean, yeah, you got to play by the rules to win some prizes, I'm afraid. And yeah, okay, his pace looked positive, but Daniel Ricciardo just seems to have a real issue with managing these ground effect downforce cars. And he has shown that his consistency, which again, previously in his career, when he was originally at Red Bull, was a real strength of his, to be able to carve his way through the field, to be able to deliver where others couldn't, is slipping away from him. So when Yuki Tsunoda is able to extract a qualifying session that delivers 10 places higher than you, it shows that the ability is there. I feel like Daniel Ricciardo is someone who he knows he's under a little bit of pressure from both the public, from the press, and of course from the internal Red Bull hierarchy to start delivering. And that pressure is causing mistakes such as these, because he could have pushed that car 1% less through that complex of corners, through turns 10 and 11 or 9 and 10, whichever it is now, and kept the car on the track. And realistically, he had the pace to get himself into Q2. He might have ended up being 14th or 15th, but it doesn't matter, because at that point you're through to Q2 and you can get back to the pits, you can reassess, and you can go again. And it's not like Yuki Tsunoda was setting the world ablaze when he was going through Q1, but he managed to deliver consistently strong lap times, which allowed him to not ever feel panicked going into the final run of the session, which meant he had to pull out an absolute wonder lap to ensure that his session carried on. So Daniel Ricciardo did show good pace, but at the end of the day, it's only good pace if you keep it within the white lines, and he didn't, and he let himself down again, and the scoreboards will show that this is Yuki Tsunoda 3, Daniel Ricciardo 0, and Ricciardo has to make up at least 6 or 7 places to be even in the fight for where Yuki Tsunoda is going to be all race long. If you ain't got the speed, you need to come up with another way. If you've got the speed, you've got to learn to deliver it on track. And Ricciardo is not doing either properly at the moment. He's not racing smart and he's not racing fast.
Yeah, I think those 6 or 7 cars in front of him, in theory, he has the car to get to beat them. Like, in terms of pure pace, Yuki Tsunoda's proven that it is possible. However, it's a different proposition to qualify ahead of cars you think you can beat and therefore, you know, go off into the distance. It's a different prospect to qualifying behind them and being like 1% faster than them, but not being able to overtake them. Because that's kind of the position that, to be honest, both Tsunoda and Ricciardo have been in over the last couple of races, is having a car that is capable of more than what they've been able to deliver, but just not quite having enough of a pace advantage to actually make it count. Now, in theory, if Tsunoda... I know Tsunoda qualified well in Saudi Arabia as well. If he can start better and doesn't get a poor pit stop and doesn't, you know, get trapped behind any other cars behind him, in theory, he should have the car to, I think, probably stay in the points, maybe the lower end of the points, but I think that fight is definitely on. With Ricciardo, he might be forced to try something different. If he doesn't have the outright pace advantage to overtake those cars in front of him, it's going to have to come via strategy or something else. So it's not ideal, as you would say.
It's not ideal. Equally, I think this is a really strong place that Daniel Ricciardo can show us what Daniel Ricciardo can do. If that car is fast enough to be, you know, up alongside a lot of the cars in front of him, and when you look at the cars in front of him, it should not be too difficult for a driver of his caliber to get through. You've got a couple of Haases, you've got Ocon in the Alpine, who's absolutely blitzed it once again. You've got Albon in the Williams, who, okay, qualified brilliantly, but is the race pace there? The hardest car, you have to argue, of course, is the fact that he's got to get possibly past either Lewis Hamilton, or he's got to get through the 2 Aston Martin guys to make it back into the points. Daniel Ricciardo has been a consummate professional when it comes to making overtakes stick. Let's see if he can deploy that once again at his home Grand Prix and show us the Daniel Ricciardo of old.
A quick mention on Haas, because they must have heard the praise we were giving them from Saudi Arabia, because they decided, nope, that's enough of that. Nico Hülkenberg, a surprise Q1 knockout, and Kevin Magnussen didn't make it much further than that. Surprised that they didn't offer a little bit more?
I mean, one good Grand Prix in them every 10 years. I think that's how it goes at the moment.
Sure.
I think what happened is I put Nico Hülkenberg into my fantasy team.
Oh, mate.
That's where I've let the side down, folks, by putting my actual faith in Haas, which was it was blasé and it was risky, and I've clearly paid the price. They've gone, no, Sam, you've slated us off for long enough. You've now put your faith in us, and we will not deliver. We will let you down immediately. And they have. Yeah, no, this is surprising. I really did think that whilst I thought Q2 was probably likely for both cars, you know, unless we've got a bit of a Hülkenberg wonder session, I was very surprised to see them so far at the back. I think they're what? They're 16th and 17th or 15th and 16th. And I would expect them to be maybe 11th or 12th or kind of 12th or 13th with the pushing, knocking on the door of that Q3 session, because the race pace was so strong around Saudi that I really thought they'd be, if Yuki Tsunoda was 10th, I really thought they'd be right there with him. Same as Alex Albon. I really thought those four were going to be almost a little bit of a group that were able to possibly be the ones knocking on the door of the point sessions to maybe disrupt the very standard set of Q3 teams that we're seeing at the moment. And they're just nowhere. The fact that Ocon was able to beat both of the Haas guys, the fact that, you know, Albon was so clear, it's really surprising to see that how quickly they went from being on such a high in Saudi to once again being slumped back down, essentially both cars out in Q1. It really was not a good turnaround of form.
Yeah, I was surprised by this because where they qualified is where it looked like they would be. Like throughout the practice sessions, you were like, well, they're not quite kicking on here as you would expect them to. And look, our expectations for Haas aren't exactly they're going to be qualifying 1-2, but Hülkenberg has semi-regularly delivered Q3 performances over the last 12 months or so. Here, never looked on the cards. And of course, unless I'm getting this wrong, if Ricciardo's lap had stuck, they would have been the only team with a double Q1 knockout, which isn't a great look. And that's why Magnussen made it through. It wasn't necessarily his own great lap that got him there. It was someone else falling afoul of track limits. And yeah, generally speaking, that's where they've been. They've been better in qualifying than they have in the race. So to see them so far down, we'll see if that race pace from Saudi Arabia reappears. But a track they usually have some good pace at, not a lot to offer.
The only thing that screams positive for me with this slightly difficult situation is that last season, their qualifying pace completely outshone their race pace. They had no ability to convert one into the other. So if this has flipped it, if we're now going the other way where they've actually gone, the race pace is sorted. We're good in the race, but they don't know how to qualify anymore. If it means they're going to spend the race going forwards rather than coming backwards, that is a positive to take away. I would rather them have to fix their qualifying pace than their race pace. So, you know, fingers crossed for your Haas. Hopefully you do move forward. At least a bit. If they finish, I don't know, 11th and 12th, that's still good progress. No points, but that is better progress.
I appreciate we'll be reviewing bold predictions tomorrow, but your Hülkenberg and putting him into your fantasy team isn't the worst thing that's happened this week.
When it happened, I'm gonna let you reveal it, but when the news came out, I audibly laughed. I did the most evil laugh ever when the news came out.
I had temporarily forgotten about it, that my bold prediction midweek was that Logan Sargeant was going to score a point. And I am utterly robbed, because I think everyone, I'd be surprised if anyone disagrees with this. Logan Sargeant was definitely on course for a point. So I think I deserve half a point because it would have been right.
I'm going to say you deserve half of nothing, which is still nothing, mate. Sorry. That's how the cookie crumbles. It's so late breaking that, you know, they've gone, your bold predictions are so bad, we're just not going to bother letting you even get one in the bag. Just before the weekend starts, just stop.
Before we get out of here, Sam, who was your driver of the session?
I'm going to give this one to Carlos Sainz. I was definitely surprised at how quick he was after recovering from that surgery. I'm even more surprised just how compounded he was in his pace against Charles Leclerc, and the fact that he's picked up a front row start. He is the man that, if he gets a good start in the race tomorrow, could spice things up. So the smooth operator for me is the driver of the session.
Fair shout. Obviously Verstappen's, as always, a contender on this. I'll give it to Yuki Tsunoda. Strong effort. I feel like he maximized what that car was capable of. And actually got a little bit more. I don't think the Aston Martins hooked up a Q3 lap, but hey, Yuki Tsunoda was there to take advantage of that. So he'll start 8th when arguably I feel like the pace of the car was probably good enough for 10th or 11th. So good job from Tsunoda again.
Alonso was not good, was he? Like, no. That was a bad Q3.
It was kind of scruffy from the... Oh, I mean, there were a couple of good laps in there, but it was even when it was good, it was a bit scrappy, I thought, from him.
I also don't understand why he then tried to hug the inside pit wall on his final run down to the pit lane. That's definitely got to be slower.
Yeah, I think that's just Alonso being Alonso.
He's just gone, this is bad. I'm just going to have fun.
Yeah, I think okay. So.
Well, my bold prediction was that Lance Stroll would beat Alonso, so we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. Stroll has the better starting position in that regard, albeit by one place. We'll be able to review that and much, much more on tomorrow's race review, which will be, another early one. We're not complaining about it, though, folks. We're not complaining about it.
No, we're yawning our way through it while we smile with silly, puffy, tired faces that we're definitely trying to recover from. Folks, thanks for tuning in. If you want to make sure you get more F1 content, we're also going to be recording our power rankings for the review tomorrow, and that goes up on Patreon. So if you want to hear our power rankings and our further thoughts about the F1 season and a classic Grand Prix review and beer we're breaking and so many other things, then check out Patreon. It helps us out massively and we appreciate it. Do tune in because we're going to be getting up for the race live, and then we immediately sit down to record this podcast the moment the race is done. So, you know, we're pushing all the way through. No complaints. We're doing it for the love of the game. And thank you so much for those of you that do join in and listen with us. Hope your bold predictions come well at home. Hope you score more points than we do. It's not hard, but still, luck is hopefully on your side, and we will see you when it does happen. In the meantime, I've been Samuel Sage.
And I've been Ben Hocking. And remember, keep braking late.
Sports Social Podcast Network.